chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them, but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. I'm your host, Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to the show. This is a very special deconstruction episode of Rom-Com Killjoys, and not the regular kind of deconstruction we do around here, but a deconstruction of a deconstruction of a deconstruction? Question mark? We're going to get into that. And joining us for this, a woman who needs no introduction because she's been on the show before, Eliza Bertrand, producer, maven.
Glad to be back.
Yes, Eliza back on the show. I'm very excited about this. And this was a suggestion from you.
Yes, this is one that right from the beginning when we said we were going to talk about some romantic movies, I thought we absolutely had to cover this.
Well, and you might as well tell the people, Eliza, what is the film we're discussing today?
So the film we are discussing today is 500 Days of Summer with Zooey Deschanel and Joseph Gordon-Levitt from 2009. Which feels like a very long time ago now. Janelle, why don't you give us a brief synopsis and then I'll give you my thoughts.
All right. Here is the summary of the movie from Google. As Eliza said, it's 500 Days of Summer, 2009, the year of our Lord, 2009. And the summary is this. Tom, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, greeting card writer and hopeless romantic, is caught completely off guard when his girlfriend, Summer, played by Zooey Deschanel, suddenly dumps him. He reflects on their 500 days together to try to figure out where their love affair went sour. And in doing so, Tom rediscovers his true passions in life. Well, that's what Google says. But Eliza, what is this movie really about?
Okay, so I love talking about movies like this because, as I've said previously, I'm a film nerd. And this movie is a deconstruction of a rom-com. As you said before, this movie takes the traditional boy meets girl story, which it very specifically in the text references boy meets girl, and flips it on its head. You know from the beginning that they are going to break up, that they're not going to end up together. And throughout the movie, the story is told non-chronologically. And so you see pieces of Tom's story during the breakup and post breakup fairly early on, and then see more and more about how the two of them started dating, how they fell for each other, how their relationship panned out as the story jumps all over the place. And so it's trying to be a little tongue in cheek and certainly referential to the entire genre of rom-coms, but it's also trying to show the main characters in a different light than what you would get if you just told the story straight through from beginning to end, which is awesome, except that if you told the story straight through from beginning to end, it would be incredibly boring and incredibly annoying because both of the people involved in this romance suck. And so this is a movie about trying to hide how much the two people in this romance suck.
Yes, I feel so many fond, nostalgic feelings for this film because it came out the summer that we graduated high school and were transitioning to college. And it was such an impressionable time in our lives. And I do remember thinking like, wow, like Summer Finn is everything I want to be in a woman. She is so assertive. She knows what she wants. She's so cool. She literally never makes mistakes. Literally.
Never.
She's literally never vulnerable. Literally. I want to be like that. Plus I want to have excellent bangs. Yes. But it's true in the end from a more wizened perspective, I say arrogantly, Summer and Tom are both kind of not the most likable characters. And the film is, I think, as you said, aware of that, especially with Tom. And yet we as viewers are asked to see the movie through specifically Tom's perspective. But it asks us to both be in Tom's perspective and also be outside of Tom's perspective, which is where I think it kind of falters as a deconstruction.
Absolutely. I think there are sort of three phases of watching this film. The first time you watch it through, and especially, you know, for us, we were younger when it came out, but I think in general, the first time you watch it through, it's fun and it's about these two very quirky characters, you know, as so many things, movies from that time period were about quirky characters. And it's an interesting way of looking at the romance. And he's sort of sarcastic and she's independent and you're very enamored with the whole thing. And then you watch it a second time and you realize that in addition to being sarcastic, he's kind of self-involved and he goes into their relationship from the start. She says, I don't really want a real relationship. I don't want anything serious. And he goes in being like, she's the love of my life. She's going to be my girlfriend. She's the one forever. And so you get very frustrated with him. And then the third time you watch it, you start to get frustrated with her because despite the fact that from the beginning she says, I don't want a real relationship, I don't want a commitment, she continually says, we're just friends. She's fully dating this man, right? Like from the moment that they start flirting at the office where they meet, they suddenly are spending all of their time together, are sleeping only with each other, are making plans for every weekend together, are staying at each other's houses, are getting into fights with each other that couples get into about like, you didn't need to stand up for me at the bar. And well, you could have been better at representing yourself as my girlfriend and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then anytime she feels uncomfortable with anything he said, she's just like, well, I've said from the beginning that we're not, you know, we're just friends. So I don't know why you're acting that way. When she is fully manipulating him because she is treating him as a full boyfriend, full relationship, and then dropping him on his head anytime it's uncomfortable for her. And so I feel like you go through phases of realizing the flaws first with him and then with her. And then you kind of have to look and be like, oh, there's flaws throughout here.
I think you're right about that because I had not seen this film in a long time and I had read a lot of the think pieces about how Tom is terrible and Tom's a deconstruction and it's really weird that people like romanticize him, but like it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. How can you not? Is there a very large place in my heart for the scene where he sings the Pixies drunkenly at karaoke? Of course there is.
Absolutely.
But this third watch, as you said, it does reveal Summer is a very manipulative figure who uses him for the boyfriend experience. And I had forgotten that she's actually the one that initiates their physical relationship by kissing him at their place of work.
Oh, which, absolutely. And not a peck on the cheek, not a peck on the lips. She full on makes out with him. Like it's a like snog in the middle of their office, which is so, so inappropriate. I'm all for an office romance storyline, and I'm even for a office physical tryst, you know, kind of thing if there's been something to build up to it. You know, if you have two people who have been avoiding each other for months or have been dating for a long time and then give into it, like that can be a great scene. But I was just so uncomfortable this time around watching this scene because he's flirted with her a little bit in ways that, you know, we're clearly flirting, but definitely still sort of like appropriate for an office setting. And then she just like attaches herself to his mouth.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And there are multiple away. Sort of pulls apart and go in. Yeah.
It's like, it's full on. And I was just sitting there like, what if someone else needs the copier?
What if someone, yeah, like what if any, and we learn later in the film that the whole office was aware that they were having this relationship, which also feels like, how was Summer not aware that everyone thought that she and Tom were a couple when the whole time she was saying that they weren't a couple?
Right.
It would have been nice to see her sort of struggle with that. It would have been humanizing to her because ultimately, even though the film asks us to be skeptical of Tom's evaluation of her as a sociopath or a robot, she kind of acts like a sociopath and a robot.
She totally does. She even, like, if we saw more of her struggling with that, more of her trying to figure out, like, do I maybe want a relationship? You know, because the idea of her being this person who her parents got divorced when she was young and she's been very, you know, unattached and very sort of dismissive of romantic love and all of that. And the idea of her being someone who then in her adult life starts to experience those things and is conflicted about whether or not she wants to give into it is great. But we don't actually see someone who's conflicted about that. We just see someone who acts completely emotionless at all times and, you know, has these trappings of a real relationship, all the while saying she has no interest in them. And then after they date for like I don't know, 8 months, 9 months, like close to a year, she breaks up with him and immediately starts dating someone else and then is married within the next year, right? I mean, like 500 days is less than a 2 year period. And then she immediately meets someone else and instantly gets married. And that felt so disingenuous to me this time around looking at it, because I was like, yes, some people get into a relationship and very quickly realize it's the right one. But if she's the kind of person who has been so against the institution of marriage and so against the idea of spending your life monogamously, she would not this quickly get engaged and married. She'd be committed to this new person, maybe, but it's so insane that you feel like, okay, is she manipulating this new man? Was she lying to Tom the whole time? Was there actually conflict happening in her head that we as the audience never see? It's very unclear.
That ending just reinforces her as the manic pixie dream bot. Like, that is her characterization. And I was so freaked out by this that I actually sought out a GitHub page where someone had gone through and like worked out the whole timeline of their breakup. And it is 7 months to the day from when they break up to the 500th day. So we know that
she's already married.
Yes. So it is something like 6 months from them breaking up to her getting married. 6 months. And if you include the time it would take to plan a wedding in LA, that's like what? They met and they were engaged a week later? I mean, good Lord. Good Lord.
Also, can we just very briefly segue into how she meets her eventual husband? Because on the 500th day, when the two of them get together and talk in the park, she tells this story that's supposed to basically just be an example of you never know when you're going to meet the right person, so you have to be open to it. Ugh. But what she says is that she was in a deli reading Dorian Gray. At which point a man came up to talk to her about it. And I was just like, that is the biggest nerd wanking into a bowl of glitter imagination of what a manic pixie dream girl is. Because, like, oh my God, she was in a deli reading Dorian Gray and a man came up to her to talk about Dorian Gray. And she was so impressed by his thoughts on this great work of literature that she had to marry him 6 months later. Ugh. Give me a break. That is the fakest thing I've ever heard.
PSA to any aspiring basic man screenwriters out there. Here, let me tell you what it's actually like when a woman is reading a book in public. Let's go back a few years to me reading Henry IV on a metro, wearing my headphones very visibly, and having a man slide up to me, poke me on the shoulder, tell me to take my headphones out and say, "What are you reading?" I say, "Shakespeare." He says, "Oh, I hate Shakespeare." That's actually what happens. So maybe don't encourage that.
There was
behavior.
Something about the detail of it being Dorian Gray, too. Like, the writer of this movie wanted you to know that she was reading a great work of literature, right? It wasn't just like I was reading a book and I struck up a conversation with the man next to me, which, while unlikely, I could buy, especially in a rom-com setting. But they wanted you to know that she was like being quirky in a deli the way that she does. And even post Tom, she's still this mansplained imagination of what the perfect woman is, to the point that I just felt like no scene with her could actually be taken at face value. And obviously the movie is from Tom's perspective, but it shouldn't be so from his perspective that I truly feel like we never met the woman.
Yes. I found that especially frustrating in the moment where they're sitting on the bench together and he sort of asks her these really important questions about, like, I don't understand, like, you were the girl who didn't want a boyfriend and now you are somebody's wife. And her explanation is, and I quote, "When I was with him," quote, I was sure of the thing I was never sure of with you," which is the most vague booky response that I've ever heard. It's not constructive criticism for Tom as to, like, here's my explanation for what worked with this guy that did not work with you. Instead, it's the manic pixie dream girl answer, which is, "I don't know, man. My feelings. I don't know. I saw a star in the sky and I followed it into a pond." Like, it's not a human response.
You don't see her having those questions when she's with him, right? Because it's not that she didn't marry him because something felt off in their relationship. She, from the start, says she has no interest in that. You know, and so if they had had this relationship that was mostly good, but then had random fights and she eventually walked out of it because it never felt right to her, I'd buy that she then met someone else and quickly fell in love and yada, blah, blah, blah. But that's not what happened. She had no interest in a serious relationship. She never questioned whether or not they could last. That wasn't even on her radar.
Yeah, I mean, when she first met Tom, she literally told him she didn't believe in love as a concept.
And then he's like, great, I'm in love with her.
She's married. She's married.
No wonder Tom's confused. And that's not to defend Tom, who's also a total douche in this movie. And I don't know that the movie doesn't want you to think he's a douche. Like, his friends continually say these things that are just like stereotypical stupid man things. And it's very clear from the start that he's not looking for the same things in the relationship that she is. Like, I think the movie's semi-aware that he's kind of a pain in the ass, but he's worse than the movie is aware of him being. And he, the whole time, to this woman who from the start, from the very first moment that they date, says, I don't want to be your girlfriend. I don't want a boyfriend. I'm not monogamous. I don't want anything long term. I don't even know how long I'll be in this job. This is all temporary. From the start, she is very upfront with him. And he, from the start, to his friends, is like, I'm in love with this girl. I have found a girlfriend. We are going to spend every second together. I can't believe that she's the one. How do I win her? I mean, like, he's such a pain in the ass that thank God it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's the only thing that makes him appealing, because he is a genuinely pleasant actor to watch.
I also, my like feminist media analysis spidey senses like went completely haywire on this watch of it, because Absolutely. Early on, something I didn't notice the first few times I watched it, early on there's a lot of commentary about how Tom is being a girl or a pussy or being really feminine, whereas Summer, literally at one point, one of Tom's friends says, oh my God, you're a dude. The way that they're positioned in terms of their approaches to relationships early on is so binary and toxic. And it made me wonder throughout if there was not greater significance to the fact that Summer's always wearing blue, which is the color we associate with boys and masculinity, and Tom's being so enamored of her. Like, I was like, this movie isn't trying to be about masculinity, but you could read it that way. You could read it about a man's journey to masculinity, but then you sort of wonder, like, but then the place that he arrives at the end of the film doesn't say much about healthy masculinity.
Right. So he hasn't suddenly, like, become masculine. Well, and of course, as with so many movies from the 2000s and the early 2010s, there is so much rampant casual homophobia that you just think, like, was this not uncomfortable when we watched it a decade ago? Because it is so uncomfortable now. You know, all of his friends just constantly are like, you're gay and that's gay and I don't want to be seen as gay and this guy in the office is gay. And it's just everywhere, to the point that I wasn't even looking for it and it kept popping out at me. And I don't know if the movie wanted us to see him as an effeminate man or wanted us to just laugh off his friends' stupid jokes. It was unclear.
I think the part of it that really bothered me on like a dating politics level was that Tom being a man, a straight man who really believes in love and fate and destiny and a soulmate, made him somehow like womanly. And that's a thread of this movie that I also was really interested in, is what it's trying to say about fate or investing in the idea of a soulmate and the one. Because my opinion is, and I want to know what you think about this, my opinion is that it starts the movie with one thesis and ends with a totally different thesis.
Yeah, I can see that. It's not consistent. And it starts the movie so definitively. You know, you get that text right at the beginning. First of all, the very first thing is him being like, is the text talking about boy meets girl and falling in love. And he calls out what's clearly supposed to be like a high school girlfriend. And it says, Jenny Beckman. Bitch.
Oh my God, I freaked.
In the text, before you've even seen any visuals in this movie. And so it begins off with this macho, aggressive, anti-female position from the start, right? Like, it is very clear. You are seeing this from a man's perspective, and we do not like women, and all exes are crazy. Just from those three words, you get that. And it's funny. Like, it's presented in a way that's meant to be humorous. You're supposed to be like, ah, ha, 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 he hates his high school girlfriend. And now that just makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, because if you think about, it's clearly in so many ways, I think, a film, and I didn't think about this at the time, but I realize now that it's really a film that was meant for a straight male audience in a way that I did not realize when I first watched it. Because when you walk away from it as a straight woman, as I am, right, the lessons that you get from it are, okay, so you can be Zooey Deschanel, you can be this like really like cool, distant girl, but eventually you're going to want to get married, wink, wink. Or you can be another kind of girl, quote unquote, and be like super desperate and really sad like Tom. But both are kind of bad because Summer's a bitch and Tom is pathetic. So there's no real good way to be feminine in this movie.
No. And the movie also, from the beginning, presents very clearly defined, with the exception of Tom maybe, defined roles of male and female and masculine and feminine. You know, there's even a moment when the movie says there's only two kinds of people in this world, women and men, which besides the trans erasure there is also clearly meant to tell you women are like this and men are like this, you know, and you've got all of these sort of relatable commentary that is definitely more relatable to a man than a woman. At one point, they're describing the character of Summer, and they say, you know, she's average height, she's average weight, and she's clearly not. She's relatively thin.
Yeah, they say she's 125 pounds average weight. I was like, in what part of the country?
And then they say that she has above average shoe size, and her size is a size 8. Which you have to know nothing about women's shoe sizes to think that a size 8 is an above average shoe size.
Right. For the record, I think it's like 7.5, like, or 8. Like, it's 7.5 to 8. Right. It's literally like average.
Like, a 9.5 and above is considered large. Like, 6.5 and below is considered small. Like, this is clearly written by a man for a male audience, even though it's got all the trappings of a traditional rom-com and even the trappings of a sort of feminized musical.
Yeah, let's talk about the style a little bit. I think that maybe that was what seduced me into watching this movie the first time, and its fabulous soundtrack.
Oh, absolutely. But you're right.
It has this sort of feminine style, but when you get into the ideology of it, it is not friendly to the feminine.
No, not at all. And it does, the thing the movie does right is the stylization. And I do think that's one of the reasons that so many of us liked this movie for so long, because it does blindside you a bit with the stylization. It's got this sort of, the world reflects what's happening in the inner workings of Tom. So when he's happy, the world is a happy movie. And when he's sad, the world is a sad movie. And you get the two sort of polar opposites of that, which I think are the two most effective scenes in the entire film, which is the musical number when things are going well for them. He's finally won the girl. He steps outside. The sun is shining. He breaks into a dance number. You get all of Central Park joining in with him, you know, and it's very bright and shiny. And there's little like animated birds flying overhead. And then the converse of that is after their breakup, you get this French New Wave movie thing that happens, which is hilarious. Like, if you've ever seen any sort of 60s French, you know, style films, it has it to a T. It's totally correct in the way that, you know, the camera is held and the black and white, even though it doesn't need to be. And their sort of close-ups of their faces at strange angles as they just say, like, depression. Depression. It's spot on, and it's so funny, and it does help represent the way he's feeling in his head. He's very melancholy, he's feeling ennui, he's feeling overly dramatic, clearly. You know, he's not just sad alone in his room, he's being performatively melancholy, performatively depressed. And those scenes really reflect what's happening in his head in a way that is relatable but still fun and funny and looks great on screen. But I think a lot of the rest of the movie pales in comparison to those moments because they're so strong.
Yes, I agree with that. I think the way that the film ends in particular is, now having seen it several times, a real disappointment after all of that stylistic experimentation, because the end feels very pedestrian in a way. The Agreed. Film is leading us on this journey with Tom where he's, you know, going through the complexity of this breakup and he even says this at some point, that it was the destruction of everything he believed about love. And as someone who recently went through a breakup that destroyed everything I believed about love, it was very personal watching him go through this. But his conclusion in the end felt very wrong to me, because ultimately his conclusion ends up being like, okay, so Summer wasn't the one, but somebody else will be, instead of like, no, fate is not something you can rely on. Like, it's a lovely construct, but it's not something you can build an architectural wonder on, to use their metaphor about his journey.
Oh my gosh. Don't even get me started on the fact that he wants to be an architect, but isn't, which is so unclear in the movie. If he studied architecture, if he like tried to get an architecture job and couldn't, if he just never pursued it. I have a whole rant that I will share at some point about architect as a job description in movies, because it's like everyone's favorite role that no one knows anything about that they just write in when they want to make someone sound interesting. But his, you know, his whole sort of philosophy of life seems very like, I could have done better and I just didn't. And that's true in his work and it's true in his love life, except that he takes no responsibility for any of it. And you get this end scene where he is going out for a job in architecture, sure, and is waiting to be interviewed. And he's talking to this woman who's also waiting to be interviewed for the same position. And, you know, they sort of hit it off. They talk about a park that they both like and some architecture that they like. And then he stops before going into the interview, doubles back, asks her for coffee, and finds out her name is Autumn. Which even the first time I watched this movie and loved it, I was still like, oh God, just kill me now. That's terrible. First of all, who's named Autumn?
Also, Autumn is the season that represents like the descent to death and decay in winter. So I was like, maybe this was not a good choice.
If one of them had been named April and the other was named May, sure, I would have been like, oh, I get it. But like going into Autumn is already, you know, all of the sort of symbolic images of death and destruction. And it's an especially odd name, which means that she's probably also quirky. And and you get, he gets this look on his face like, oh my God, I have found the one, which goes against everything that he's supposedly learned about you having to take the time to get to know someone. Like, he doesn't know anything about this woman. And yet you're already supposed to, as the audience, believe that this is the solution to all of his problems with Summer. This new quirky woman will suddenly fix all of that. And there's nothing that we know that she has that makes her any different from Summer. Summer was also supportive of him trying to work in architecture. Summer was also cute and friendly and easy to talk to. And that's literally all we know about this woman. She has no additional qualities that make us think, oh, this will fix the problems he had previously. And yet the look on his face seems to imply.
No, it's true. And that ending, like you said, I mean, what it teaches us is that Tom has not changed anything about how he approaches relationships. Oh, no. What he has changed is his career. And as a man, that is the thing that really matters. So it's really good that he's done that, because that's going to transform his entire life and outlook, not the interpersonal or personal soul searching that he probably should have done after this breakup. And, you know, the realization that fate and the one is not a concept that works for him. No, no, no. Architecture. Architecture, as always, is the answer.
Sure.
Okay. Well, what are our final takeaways about 500 Days of Summer, Eliza? What can we learn? What can we learn from this movie? What can we derive from it?
I feel like this movie would be really interesting to see remade now. And not that I'm advocating for remakes. I prefer, you know, original stories. But to see someone who had the same concept, same basic idea, try to make a movie now, I feel like you would get a very different product. Because what this movie is trying to say is that not all relationships work out, and there's still things that you can take away from a relationship that are positive and that are good, and that can help you in the future, even if a relationship itself doesn't last forever and is imperfect. But what it shows us is two imperfect people, neither of whom is willing to look inwardly and work on themselves, rather than showing us an imperfect relationship that leads to healthier things down the line. So ultimately, it is much more frustrating than satisfying.
Yes, I agree with that. And I mean, piggybacking on your idea about a remake, I would love to see a version of this film redone a la High Fidelity, where it's sort of the gender stuff is mixed around and the sexuality stuff is mixed around. Because I think that you'd tell a very 2020 kind of story if you actually had a female Tom who was pursuing perhaps a man, but perhaps any person, right? Like, because part of my bigger meta issue with rom-coms, and especially this one, is that desperation is this feminine quality, but it's always looked at as bad. And I would be interested to see if they could pursue desperation or like interest or pursuit by a feminine person as something that is like romantic and good, because it's almost always portrayed as very bad. And that's not good for women who are trying to pursue relationships.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? And in fact, as a queer story, this could be really interesting, because I think a lot of queer relationships, because of the history of the way that homosexuality is treated, and has been treated in the past, a lot of queer people don't necessarily see themselves living that sort of stereotypical heterosexual romance. Either they don't see themselves getting married, or they don't see themselves having only one partner, or whatever it is. So you could have the Summer character be, say, a lesbian who, you know, is really excited to date, but just never figured that she would settle down and get married and have all those trappings. And then a lesbian who's much more interested in the more sort of traditional style romance, and then see the two of them struggle with that. You could have a lot of the same elements that this movie has, but it would just be much more interesting and much more complex as far as the character study.
Yes. Yes. I really like this. Okay. Invitation to any and all aspiring screenwriters out there. Write that adaptation. Make it happen.
And hit us up. We'll help you figure out how to do it. We will be here to support you.
We are here to support you. All right. Well, we needed to wrap up and transition to our end of the show. But before we do that, I just want to give a shout out to our patrons, especially Bob and Esther. Thank you so much for your support. It's been awesome to see how many of you have shown up to support the show so far, even though it's been a short journey. But thanks a lot.
Yeah, we're really grateful for everyone who's listening, and all of our patrons on Patreon, and anyone who has liked us on social media, listened to the podcast, everything. We're glad that you guys are enjoying it.
Yes, thanks a lot, guys. And as a reward to you, as we do every week, it's time for our antidotes. Eliza, what are your antidotes to 500 Days of Summer?
So I have two. They both sort of deal with this element that 500 Days of Summer had of playing around with the genre that the story takes place in. The first one, if one of the things you liked about 500 Days of Summer was this telling of a love story in a non-chronological order, this sort of messing around with the traditional way of depicting a story and using that in order to look at what's happening inside of the people involved, I think you should check out, if you have not watched it already, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It is a fantastic movie that is about a slightly futuristic world in which the technology exists to erase memories from one's head. And so Jim Carrey, in one of his most wonderful serious roles, plays a man who has paid to have the memories of his ex-girlfriend erased from his head. But as they are slowly taken from him, and he loses the negative memories from the end of their relationship, his psyche, his internal psyche, wants to hold on to the positive memories from the beginning of the relationship. And it is literally an internal battle, because it takes place inside of his head to save those memories that were good from this relationship. And it is a fascinating movie, really like no other. It's a bit of a thriller and a bit of a sort of psychological mind mess, and it's a bit of a love story, and it's just wonderful. It's really well done, incredibly unique, which I hate saying because I know everything that's unique is unique, but it's incredibly unique. And I think it's worth a look. So take your time and go and watch that. The other thing that I will suggest is a television show, which also plays around with the concept of love stories and of rom-coms, and that is Jane the Virgin. Jane the Virgin, which is a TV show that aired for 5 seasons, I believe, on the CW, is a telenovela. It is a modern Americanized telenovela, but it is a love letter to telenovelas and soap operas. And it is also a brilliant parody of them. It is larger than life. It is bright and colorful. I've literally never watched a more colorful television show. The art department is fantastic, but it's amazing because it has all of the trappings of a soap opera or a telenovela, in that it has, you know, evil twins and kidnapped babies and surprise pregnancies and all of that kind of stuff. But it also has incredibly touching, realistic portrayals of female friendships and female family dynamics, intergenerational dynamics. It has smart, whip smart political commentary. It has incredibly funny and intelligent dialogue. It's got all of those things. And if you really love a good romance, but you want to see one that is just a little more intelligent than this movie ended up being, Jane the Virgin is a great thing for you to binge while you are home right now.
My antidote is really addressing the kind of soulmate or the concept of the one that's working in the movie. I feel like in 500 Days of Summer, this concept is shoehorned. It's obviously being critiqued a lot. But I think that that idea can be quite romantic and non-problematic, especially in films like Moonlight, written by the incredible playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney and directed by the brilliant Barry Jenkins. It's the story of a young queer Black man growing up into manhood in Miami, primarily. And it's honestly, it's a poem set to screen. It's just absolutely scrumptious and gorgeous in every possible way. But it also has at its center a love story between two people that is got all of the qualities of this sort of soulmate idea, but without forcing that idea upon their relationship in a way that I find romantic and compelling and honest. And it also includes a scene on a beach that I found so unbelievably elegantly erotic that I was holding on to the armrests in my movie theater. So if you haven't seen it, you really, really, really should. I can't recommend it enough.
I think we were all holding on to the armrests in our movie theater when we got to that scene.
Right? It's just, oh, I can't, I'm going to go watch it after this. It's just so beautiful. It's so beautifully done. Well, Eliza, it's a pleasure as always. You know, you're not always in front of the mic, but it's always a good thing to have you here.
I love talking to you about this stuff. And I think I would love to hear what everyone else feels about 500 Days of Summer, either what they feel about it now or what they felt about it when they first listened to it, however long ago.
Yes, let's get some nostalgia feedback. I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, don't be embarrassed. We all know we loved it when we first saw it. You don't have to, you know, hide your head behind your college feminism. It's okay.
Yeah, were we all blasting the soundtrack from our dorm rooms?
Hell yeah.
Thanks, Eliza.
Thanks, Janelle.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked this episode, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Rom-Com Killjoys. And if you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys to gain access to exclusive bonus content. Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog. And the song you're listening to now is a cover of one of my favorites, Baby Love, by Colin Langanis. Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy. Not a rom-com, not me, not anyone. See you next time.